I'm Eric Heiden.
I'm Nick Mason.
And this is Neon Static. Welcome to episode 15 of Neon Static. We've got some stuff in store for you, and we are going to try and get through it quickly because we're recording this for a second time.
Yeah.
Magic of podcasts.
Yep.
What we have in store for you are some rules about res windows and paidability windows and the nuances within and thereon and thereof.
And
those are all words.
And then we're going to talk about our Netrunner wish lists from the last episode, where we talked about what we wanted to see in Liberation Part 2. And then we're going to talk about what we saw in Liberation Part 2 and find out, did we wish upon a star or upon a monkey's paw?
And its curling effects.
Exactly.
But before we get into the episode, we want to thank our patrons whose support is helping us build a better show. And if you want to support the podcast and YouTube channel, check out patreon.com/neonstatic. And with that, we're going to move right into 24/7 news cycle. Okay, so first off, we want to announce that we are having a meme contest. We like Netrunner memes. We like memes about things that only we can understand and other people look at and are confused.
Yeah.
So, and we have to like try and explain to our significant others why it's funny and they look at us and wish that we didn't try and do this. It's definitely a thing that I don't do, I promise. So what we're doing is you can create up to 5 original memes that you have come up with yourself. No resubmitting old memes. That will be frowned upon. And guess what? Everybody from the community has the opportunity to go look at these, so they'll know. So don't do that. Come up with original Netrunner memes, email them to neonstaticpod@gmail.com and include the subject line has to include Neon Static 2024 meme contest. And the rules for all this will be in the description. So don't worry if you don't catch it just here. The deadline for submittal is Sunday, April 21st, 2024. And after that, we'll have a week where we publish a Padlet for these memes and everyone can go and vote on their favorites. And then on Monday, April 29th, we're going to host one of our regular live streams will be a meme reveal stream. And we'll go through and show the memes off. Nick will see them for the first time. He's not getting to see them right now.
Correct.
For reasons. Just so it's more fun for Nick.
Those live reactions.
And the winner.
So you can get the part where I go, wait, what? And Eric has to go, wait. Well, so this paidability window. Anyway.
The winner of the popular vote will receive a full set of our Neon Static poker chips that we play on stream with. And then we'll also each pick a favorite, and those winners will also receive a smaller prize. So if you're interested, please do that. I've been watching the memes come in. It's been a lot of fun. So only about 3 weeks left for that. Nick, what else?
The other big thing is the non-PC, N-A-N-P-C, the North American Netrunner Players Circuit. So this is a non-NSG, like not directly NSG-associated tournament circuit going on all across the North American continent. They've already had one tournament in Vancouver. There's one coming up April 20th and 21st in Toronto. And then the one that is relevant for us, I think, or most relevant, is there's a Boston one, 25th and 26th of May. So, they look to be great events. A lot of them are going multiple days. So there's side events and lots of custom prize support and just a whole bunch of fun to be had.
They've got a custom fermenter with art by Scott Uminga. They apparently will have some custom dice, custom Hyperloop extension. That was at the Vancouver one and other West Coast events. So yeah, more cool prizes to be announced. It looks to be like a good time. We're going to be at the Boston one. Nick will be there. I will most likely be there. And yeah, come out. Say hi. It'll be great. One last thing we wanted to mention on the podcast that we are going to Worlds. Nick and I are going to both be at Worlds. I'm probably looking to book tickets actually pretty soon because the flights seem pretty good right now.
Mm-hmm.
From our neck of the woods out to, well, who are we kidding? San Francisco doesn't have any woods, but
yeah.
to that place. Yeah, Worlds got announced between our last podcast and this one, and we're super excited. It's in October, right? It's October like 17th.
That sounds correct. Yes.
Let's see. Let's just check real quick. October 17th is the Thursday. It's the day that we would be traveling. And then Friday, the 18th, there'll be a team event. And then Saturday on the 19th and Sunday on the 20th is Worlds proper. So we're going, we hope to see you there. Come on out. You know what we look like from the streams. If not, go check out our YouTube channel and then you'll know. We can have a nice chat.
So next up then, we're going to go to Spec Work. Learn a bit about rules.
Too long, don't read. You can't res cards as the corp during an encounter. I didn't realize this. And it is obvious if you look at like the timing window cheat sheet that floats around GLC, there's a little blue circly symbol for, you know, the corp resin cards, and then there's a green credit symbol for a paid ability window. Well, there's no blue circly res window during an encounter. You might ask why that's relevant, and it's usually probably not, but there are instances where it matters, such as, let's say, hypothetically, a runner is about to run into, they face check into a drafter, and they can't break it, or maybe they could break it, but they think it's too expensive, and they say, just go ahead and fire. I don't see anything in your archives anyway, and you have no cards in hand, so what's the worst that can happen? You can't then res a spin doctor to find a card to install with the drafter because you're during an encounter. You also can't like res a prana condenser after learning that a sub is going to fire that does net damage to cash in on that card. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's not something that I think has ever come up for me, but I could see how it could come up, and it's definitely not a rule that I was aware of. Like, I thought almost any paid ability window was also a res window. Obviously different for ice, but it's an interesting one.
Yeah. Our hypothesis is that you probably don't want, as a game designer, you don't want the runner to be in the situation where they say, fire your subs, and then the corp goes, cool, I'm first going to res this card that gives all my ice in the server a really, really nasty subroutine. Now I'm going to fire it.
Yep.
Oh, too late. You can't break it. You already passed back your paid ability window. That seems probably like the reason. And that's all we have for rules.
All right. Shall we go into the depths?
Let's.
Last time on Neon Static.
Win condition.
I kind of want criminals to murder more people.
Apocalypse.
Accessing adjacent cards would be cool.
We talked about what we wanted to see in Liberation Cycle, and now it's here, and now we can compare that to what we see. And see what we see. So what were the things that we said last time, Eric?
One thing that we said was that we wanted to see more installables that feel like hacking. I'll just kind of go in order. I think I used a reference to like Time Bomb. Like you get into the server and you got in there and you can plant a bomb or you can do a thing. You know, you get into the building and you bug the room, things like that. Those were things that I was interested in. We also... Later in the episode, it's funny, all this kind of revolves around one card. You said that you wanted to see an alternate win condition.
Yes.
For runner.
Yeah, that was kind of my big thing. Although I was, I think, hoping they would do it through rules rather than...
I thought you might be meaning that, yes. You said that you wanted to see criminal doing more criminally things. And I brought up the unregistered Smith & Wesson. You know, as like a piece of example of a thing that used to kind of be very criminally, because it's like a gun that you go shoot someone with.
Yeah.
And then Chechino came out.
Yes. Yeah. So they took of our wishes for, you want to kill people with weapons? You want alternate win cons?
Yeah.
Well, here you go.
Yeah, that they must have been like just biting the ends of their tongue off,
right?
Because I'm sorry for that imagery. Trigger warning. Yeah, it's literally exactly what we were asking for. Alternate WinCon and like a criminal, like nasty kill people thing.
Yep. Yeah. And no, it's perfect.
Yeah. How do you even spell it?
J-E-I, I think.
J-E-I-C-Genome.
And then some other letters.
J-E-I-T-I-N-H-O. So it's, if you haven't been following along with Rebellion Without Rehearsal, this is the new win condition that came out in this set. It is a one cost unique hardware subtype weapon. When your turn ends, and it's a big knife. When your turn ends, if you made a successful run at HQ, R&D, and Archives this turn, you may add this hardware to your score area as an assassination agenda worth 0 agenda points. Then, if you have 3 assassination agendas in your score area, you win the game. Threat 3, whenever you bypass a piece of ice, you may spend click to install this hardware from your heap, and it is 4 influence criminal card. And that's the thing. I said I wanted an alternate win condition for runner, so did you. And it's an alternate win condition for criminal.
Yes. Yeah, because what? It's 4 influence, right?
4 influence, yeah.
Like there are actually characters or IDs in the game like Kit that cannot, mm-hmm. you know, you could put in 2/3 of a win condition, but you could not win the game with it.
I really like the idea of running a cheeky one of this in the unique one.
Nova.
The neutral. Nova.
Yeah. Perfect.
Just to screw. Because like.
You play it and they're like, oh my God, I got to button up one of my centrals.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's Aesop's fodder, so.
Yeah, but there's better.
It'd be great.
Oh no, because you can bring it back every time you bypass. Okay. All right. I'm seeing it. I mean, it's not good, but I'm seeing it.
It's not good. Yeah. So what do you think? This is like, our prayers were answered. How do we feel?
So I was... So, all right. Card-based win conditions are difficult to balance in games, so I kind of understand why they ended up where they did. But honestly, if you're able to run HQ, Archives, and R&D in one turn, like, consistently... Yeah, you can use that to win the game in better ways, like play Deep Dive. Obviously, that's a lot of influence if you're not out of Shaper, but like there are other cards that could win you the game through that, or you know, you are also just easily getting into every central. Why don't you just do multi-access and win the game that way? Like there's a lot simpler things that you can do.
So you're down on it.
So I think as a card design, this is one of the reasons that I wanted to see it as a rule, because as a card design, this sort of thing can't be great. If it's great,
it should not be.
Exactly. If it's great, it's going to warp the entire game around it, and you're going to end up in a bunch of things where, you know, the corp has some answer to it, but if they tech that into their deck, then they are necessarily making their deck worse against other things because it's only going to work against this one weird trick. So like, yeah, these things just, they can't be like super, super good. And if they are, they screw up the whole game. But that
corpse hate him.
Yes, exactly. Because of his one weird trick, which is knifing people to death.
Which is stabbing 3 executives.
Yes.
To death.
Yep. In a very telegraphed manner.
First they unsheathe their sword and run all around.
Yep.
And then find you.
Exactly. So like on that side, I get it. But like if it were like a rules-based thing, then you could design a whole bunch of cards around it. And I don't think that a mid-cycle thing is the time to introduce that. You know, maybe you would do it with Dawn, but even then I would be surprised to see it. Something along the lines of flatlining for the corp, you know, something like that on the runner side.
I never expected to see a rules update. I always expected a card update because if they bake it into the rules of the game and then it proves to be not fun or toxic or whatever, then they can't just they could just errata the rules to remove the thing, but in this case, they can just ban the card.
Yes. Yeah. No, that is definitely true. And it's one of those things that I would love to see it, but I don't know that there is actually room to do it design wise. So I think you're
Have we seen a deck that like is since release is doing this consistently and like winning?
I haven't looked super closely. My understanding is that a lot of the decks that were doing it were basically like you either win by turn five or you lose the game. You know, you are just loading up on card draw and things to find your knives and bypass. And when you run out of bypass, that's it. Good game.
From what I remember, at the first NPC event, in the top cut, Sid 7 was playing, on the runner side, was playing a Sable deck that ran 3 Jaichino.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know, the write-up, it doesn't make it clear. And we haven't seen the episode or the actual gameplay. There's no write-up. It's just a bunch of memes.
yep, that would make it not clear.
A bunch of knives. But it does seem like it won there. And it was this Matryoshka Tycoon deck. Yeah, it was 6 Matryoshka, 1x Tycoon, 3x Wizard's Chest, which is the new hardware that helps you fetch anything.
Yep.
If you've run successfully on HQ, R&D, and Archives. Mm-hmm. So if you get one of the like the Wizard's Chest and a Jaichino down and you do the triple run, you can pop it to go get more Jaichinos. And actually, on the way, it can go find another Wizard's Chest, right?
Oh, yeah.
Set aside. Choose hardware, program, and resource. Set aside from the top of your stack face up until you set aside 2 cards of the chosen type. So if you choose hardware, this has 1 Hermes, 3 Jaichinu, and 3 Wizard's Chest. You may install one of those 2 cards, ignoring all costs. And then, you can install, if you see 2 Wizard's Chests, you just pop one of them after you install it to do the same thing again.
True. So you're always going to use this to be able to find one of the knives, basically, if that's what you're looking for.
Right. And if you see a Hermes and a Wizard's Chest, you can install the Wizard's Chest and pop it again. You shuffle everything back in your deck, so...
Yeah.
I don't know. So apparently it did, because this deck is not winning through multi-axis. There's no multi-axis to be found here.
Gotcha. That's interesting. I'll have to take a look.
Maybe we should give it a try.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, well, you know, that was the only time I've seen it pop up so far. Not that I've been watching like ABR results like a hawk. So.
Yeah. So what about you? You said you wanted installables that feel like hacking. Now, I mean, this is... hacking in the sense of you're hacking at a person with a knife. I guess that's a thing you could do, but
good one.
Yeah, right.
Yes, hacking. Haha. I don't think that I've seen anything that feels like I'm just trying. I mean, direct privileged access kind of feels a little bit like that.
Yep.
Thematically, right? You're running archives and you've got the special pass card and you go in and you can get your stuff back.
The other one that I was thinking of, I'm blanking on the name, but it's the Crim Trojan that you can pay money to bypass an ice.
Yeah.
Not exactly like the physical hacking that you were talking about, but it is kind of a Crim style, you know, infiltration thing.
Yeah, this is killing me. What is it called? It is called Ficerum Entangler.
Sounds correct.
Yes. Install a piece of ice. Whenever you encounter a host ice, if it's not a barrier, you may pay 1 credit for each subroutine it has if you do bypass that ice. I really like that design, by the way, of if it's not a barrier.
Yes. Yeah. If it's not specifically the type that keeps you out of things.
Right.
Yeah.
And I've played this card a fair amount, a little bit since it's come out. And, you know, I've been in situations where you blind install it and then they res and it's a barrier. And, you know, you just took the chance and it didn't pan out. playing against a bunch of Asmari lately. Asmari's been pretty hot.
Yeah.
Around, I've seen a lot of it. And you're like, okay, well, that's probably, they're on the money. They have 12 credits or whatever. I'm going to play the Physarum blind on that, assuming it's a Hydra. And then you run it and expecting to potentially just pay 3 credits to bypass the Hydra, which feels great, especially if they have to pay the full 10 credits. It might just prevent them from rezzing it in the first place.
Right.
If it's trade 10 for 3. And then they rez, like, was it you or it might have been Derek who was just rezzing? It was Derek. What's the anti-AI gear check? Fractor, no Fractor, plus 7 strength.
Oh, wraparound, yeah.
Wraparound, yeah. It was just a wraparound, and I was like, damn it.
Yep.
But it felt cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. What else? I really like... This is just now... It's not the same idea of, like, hacking, but I really like the cards that they came out with, like Helium Fora.
Yes.
And Cupellation that let you host agendas on the cards, on those programs, and then potentially do stuff with them. Well, actually, Helium Fora doesn't do anything with it. It just keeps it hostage.
Right. And that's, it's funny because that was not a effect that I had like thought of at all, you know, just completely removing something, you know, kind of exiling it from the corpse reach.
Right.
It's pretty neat. In both cases, because they both do really different things. But yeah, it was just very surprising to see that as a mechanic, and maybe that's just not knowing enough of the card pool. I'm sure these are similar to other cards that existed in the past.
Film Critic is the big one that used to exist, and it was a one of basically mandatorily in every deck. It was a one influence shaper card resource. And it said, whenever you access agenda, you may host, whenever you access an agenda, you may host that agenda on Film Critic. That agenda is no longer being accessed and is uninstalled. And then you can go click on your next turn to add an agenda hosted on Film Critic to your score area.
Oh, wow.
So you never steal agendas. You don't have to pay the 5 for Bologna. You host it on Film Critic, and the next turn you spend 2 clicks and you get it. So it was a one turn delay, but it really took all the teeth off of nasty effects.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I mean, even, you know, stuff like Send a Message is not that scary.
Right.
I bet PE and it thematically hated made that.
It's so little sense. It didn't make any sense thematically. I was like, well, yeah, your bad agenda is happening, but I have a Film Critic who's going to critique your Bologna, and now I get to take it away. And it was like, what? Why? The flavor text was, my gerbil could write a better screenplay. And it was all about, that whole cycle was about, it was an old Hollywood, it was the pack it came out in. And it was like a whole thing about the new Hollywood that existed.
Yeah, that's a weird, I mean, I can kind of see it, like, you know, somebody puts out a like propaganda movie and the Film Critic like gets an early look at it at the, you know, premiere before everybody else does, and then writes a thing about how, guys, this is just a dumb propaganda movie, nobody go watch it, and the agenda they were trying to push is defused or something.
Yeah, there was an agenda that came out in that cycle called Explodapalooza that was a 4/2, and when you accessed it, if Explodapalooza accesses from R&D, the runner must reveal it. When the runner accesses Explodapalooza, you may gain 5 credits. And it was like a movie. And I think the idea was that the runner was going to see the movie. I don't know.
Amazing.
And your Film Critic said it's a bad movie, and so you don't get any money.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's great. Okay, so let's move on to the next thing. You said that you miss big flashy events like Apocalypse.
Yes. Yeah.
And when you were talking about Apocalypse, I was thinking about the, you know, run all 3 centrals and get to do a cool big thing. And we did get some of that. We got Wizard Chess and we got Jichinyu. I don't think we got any other big ones, but what's your take on this?
So I think they added a flashy event, but it's not like one of those. It's not like an event that requires a ton of setup. But it is, in the same way that Apocalypse is, kind of a reset event. Specifically here, I'm talking about Ashen Epilogue. It's a 5-cost, 2-influence neutral that I can pull up the actual text on. But basically, you're going to shuffle your... shuffle your grip and heap into your stack, then remove the top 5 cards of your stack from the game. Draw 5 cards. Remove this event from the game. So it just is a total like reset, except for whatever 5 cards get removed. So if you're playing a deck that burns through resources really quickly and ends up in a situation where like late game, you know, your heap is full, but you have a very limited set of tools on the board or in your hand, you can just reset it. Similarly, right. You play this against like PE after they've done a whole bunch of chip damage to you, presuming this can dodge the chip damage, and PE just cries.
Yeah, if you can avoid, if you can avoid losing it. And notably, it's a 2-influence neutral event. And that is notable because this is effectively a reprint of Levy AR Lab Access, which was a 3-influence Shaper card that did all the same stuff and cost the same, except you didn't remove the top 5 cards of your stack from the game.
Right.
So it's an attempt to make it rebalance because Levy has a history in like prepaid Kate decks where you go through, you have a ton of events, you install a bunch of prepaid voice pads, and then you fire this, and you can then play those events for free later, and you're just, you know, infinite economy, effectively. But now Shaper has to pay influence for it. It removes some cards from the game. I still think it's about the same, probably. It's a neat card. It can feel bad as the corp, for sure, when you're like think you're starting to pull ahead, and then the epilogue comes out, and... and everything gets reset and you're like, oh God, oh no.
Right.
I better win fast.
Like that's kind of the thing that I was thinking about. So initially I said that, you know, this seems like it should be like Apocalypse, but it didn't really feel that way. And then I kind of thought about it from the corpse side, right? I mean, you know, you've gone through all of their threats, you know, okay, I've dealt with all their botulists, all their simul chips are out of the deck and all this. And then they just play this card and it's all like you have to think about all of it again. And yeah, the odds that they draw it that next turn are pretty low, but you know, it's not quite feeling as exposed as an Apocalypse will leave you because, you know, you just, all of your servers are open at that point and you got to button them up quick. But it definitely does reduce that like sort of late game ability for the corp to be like, okay, I have this on lock.
I do. What I do like about it is you can't do the thing, and I don't know if this was prevalent, but you can't do the thing where you like play 3 Shatuskas in the first 5 turns, and then when you used to be able to do something like Levy just to put them back, you need to wait a while now. Because if you do it relatively early, those Shatuskas are going to get removed from the game.
What do you mean?
Or most of them will. Like, so if you played, let's say somehow you had the economy to play all 3 Shatuskas and your bin, there's like 6 cards in your heap.
Mm-hmm.
You can't play Ashen Epilogue and get them back. You can get 1 card back.
No. You're misreading. So you shuffle your grip and heap.
You shuffle
into
them in
your
and
stack.
Remove.
Yeah, the odds are always the same that you lose any one particular card.
You're okay. You are right. I was misreading. Yeah. Okay.
So you can do exactly that, triple Shatuska, and then just reset if you want to.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I don't know if that's really. I think the primary use case is going to be the thing that I described. But it might also just be like you trashed my 1 of breaker. I better go hope I find it, and then hope it doesn't get RFG'd.
Right.
It's like a panic button, but we'll see.
Yeah. So. You also said that you wanted asset spam decks to do something other than kill you.
Yeah, because that seemed to be the general idea. Kill you, grind you down to kill you, flatline you with a combo with like Reaper Function and SIU, I think, to give you a tag and then do an end of line.
Yeah.
I think it's SIU is the card that does that. Yes, when your turn begins, you may trash SIU to trace three. If successful, give the runner one tag.
Yep.
Okay, so I think we got that, right?
Yes, but...
Kind of?
specifically, the thing that I'm thinking about is the Nottigan's Blighttown deck, which is an asset spam list, and it does score agendas to win the game. But it also seems like the most evil thing you can do.
Uh-huh.
Like the runner just gets like two clicks a turn if they want to deal with any of these assets. So good luck. Good luck, buddy.
Yeah. And it's doing that through that deck in particular is doing it through Front Company, MCA austerity policy. What else?
Mirror Morph just in general being efficient.
Ganked.
Yeah. The ganked seems nuts. Just so much stuff. And of course, like a Trieste. Model Byroids to set up your relatively unbreakable ice. You've got Loki in there if you need it, but for the most part, you can deal with
Warden Fatuma.
Yes.
Yeah. Losing clicks.
Yep. Yeah. Just this incredibly taxing deck that does end up fast advancing things with MCA austerity policy and a really clever trick with Lady Liberty, where you keep de-rezzing it to keep it at exactly three power counters so you can score your 5/3s from hand with it on multiple turns.
Yeah, yeah. You derez it with, which one? Was it Warm Reception? What's the one that
derez? Yes, Warm Reception.
When your turn begins, you may install one card from HQ. You cannot score that card this turn. If this server is not protected by ice, you may derez this asset to derez another installed card.
Yeah.
So okay, so you install it. Or turn begins, you have a Warm Reception up.
Yep.
You can install something.
Yep.
You can't score it. That's fine. You derez that thing, and then you after you Lady Liberty. Oh, that's on turn start though.
Well, so what you're doing here is you are starting your turn. Your Lady Liberty has three. And you want to keep
gets its
it
power
at
counter
three.
On the start of turn.
Right. And you just order the triggers so that Warm Reception goes off first to turn the Lady Liberty face down. So the Lady Liberty power counter gain does not go off.
Yeah. If only Lady Liberty was like more than a one of in the deck, how do you find it? But anyway.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's one thing. But I mean, you are also able to do all the crazy fast advance stuff with MCA austerity policy where you're just sitting there taxing them clicks and then all of a sudden, boom, 5/3 from hand.
This is out of Mirror Morph. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So,
of course it is. MCA is always out of Mirror Morph.
Yeah. So just a ton of, but it is an asset spam deck that does not flatline you.
Yeah. It just creates a lockbox.
Yeah. I mean, we learn from this deck that there are indeed fates worse than death and even in Netrunner.
It's wild to me that that deck does not have active policing in it, which is the new Operation Grey Ops terminal, which is zero cost, play only if the runner stole or trashed a corp card during their last turn. After you resolve this operation, your action phase ends. You may install one card from HQ. The runner gets -1 allotted click for their next turn. And on threat three, you may pay two credits. If you do so, the runner gets -1 allotted click for the next turn again.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, the terminal part of that makes it weird with Mirror Morph, I believe. I'm not sure. Like, it ends your action phase. Does that allow your Mirror Morph? Like, you can get the click from Mirror Morph, but I think you can only use it for the gain a credit version because you don't have an actual window to spend the click before the turn ends, obviously. Same as if you had played this as your first event.
You may gain one credit or take another different action paying click less. Including playing a card.
Yeah, but so this ends your action phase. So it's after you resolve this operation, your action phase ends, period.
You do three things, and then you play that thing on your extra click.
Yes.
You play
that would work.
Active policing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think it might just be overkill, honestly. Like, you already, with just the basic setup of MCA austerity policy and Front Company, you tax the runner 2 clicks every turn before they can start dealing with your asset spam.
Yeah, it's kind of gross.
And like the centrals get buttoned up really well as well with Fatuma and things like that. It has tech in it for our Aruceris crew. Like it just has like so much annoying stuff.
Oh, that we're getting way off topic, by the way, but that's the Malia.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, so that deck exists. Are you happy about it?
I don't know. I haven't played against it yet. I'm sure I won't be. That's yeah. And I did say that, you know, given the choice between what did I say? I basically said that I prefer honest, like regular old style Netrunner to asset spam. And I'm sure I will, yeah, in general asset spam. But I don't know. I kind of wanted there to be like a non-toxic asset spam deck out there, but I don't know if that exists.
Yeah, I don't know. Like the whole asset spam archetype, right? The idea behind it is that, you know, you're throwing out all this stuff that doesn't matter that much to you, but it does matter a lot to the runner. It's like, it is like a taxing grinder kind of thing, except for like the mutually assured destructions and stuff like that, right? So
yeah, I played against an ag infusion asset spam deck that I was like, why is this out of ag? This doesn't make any sense. Until the player, and this was just online, the player rezzed just a Sisenton, I think, and then kept booping me into the Sisenton, and it was, you know, it was like a bladderwort, you know, stuff going out there doing lots of little pings of damage, and eventually I got down to 0 cards in deck and won on like the, you know, the very last click access. And I was going to die the next turn because there was 2 bladderworts rezzed and I could not trash them.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I don't know. It got down to it. But man, that was a long and grinding game. And I was like, why, what about just Netrunner? This is a different game.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know it's not, but it's not my preferred. So we'll see. Maybe this will be absolutely horrible. Thanks, not again.
Entirely possible, yes.
Yes. What else? Do we have anything else? I want to see more. Oh, the spatial stuff.
Yes. Yeah, that didn't really come up at all, right?
Yeah, I said I wanted more cards that play with the spatial aspect of Netrunner. And I can't think of anything that did that in this set.
I think the closest you get is Trick Shot, where it runs a central, yes, and then it bounces over to a remote.
Yep, but that is one.
Even that, like, that's, I guess, not really like, that's not spatial so much, because the distinction between centrals and remotes has always been a pretty big thing. So,
right. Spree kind of host one installed Trojan program and a piece of ice protecting the attack server. Spree bops things around, but it's not really playing with spatial aspects.
Yeah.
I can't think of any other cards, looking, just flipping through here, that did anything like that? No, not that I can think of. I mean, it's Tributary is a card that like keeps going to the outside of servers, and the mental counterplay to that card is kind of like that. I don't know, where you have to like, I want to attack this remote, but I don't want Tributary to make all the ice stronger. So first I'm going to run over here to get them to bait out the Tributary.
Right.
Res and hope they do it there. There's some kind of cool back and forth because of that. Although Tributary is going to get old real fast.
But like,
because it's even everywhere. It pops up, you know, once you find it, it's every single turn that you're going to deal with it.
Right. But so even then, right, so that's like the outermost. Like I thought of your thing as asking for, like, you know, run server one and then you can access an adjacent server.
Yeah, I wanted horizontal interaction and not vertical.
And I don't, right? Know,
I didn't want
so to, rules wise, I don't know if that is supported, because I don't, like, there is the, like, you know, set way that people lay out their boards for the most part. But it's not required that you do it that way. It's just the accepted shorthand.
Oh, I agree. There is no rules infrastructure for adjacency of remotes. And like, your first remote that happens to be closest to HQ or R&D, and what order you keep HQ and R&D in. And, you know, I think most people who aren't monsters do HQ and then to the left of that R&D and to the left of that your archives.
Right.
From the perspective of the corp. But who's to say they don't switch that because it's too powerful when people get into HQ late game by playing a card that adjacents, you know, hopefully would only say an adjacent remote server, but sometimes people put remotes like when there's too many of them all over their mats.
Yeah, you just end up with them stacked. And no, there was a guy in Magic who like won tournaments early on by he played with all of his lands up front and then all of his creatures in back, which is the exact opposite of how most people played.
Right.
And they actually ended up making a rule because it got so confusing for people as to like what he actually had on the board that they would.
He just won because they made mistakes.
Basically, there was a land card that was also a creature and he would put it among his lands and then attack you with it.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Magic has had such a storied history of like weird crap like that. Like the one we were talking about the other day where you tear it up and drop it.
Oh, yeah. The orb of destruction, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah.
The confetti magic orb.
I don't envy that game and the players of it. I think that's all the things that we like had a review on our wish list. Are there any other cards that you wanted to like talk about being excited about out of the new set?
So honestly, we've already mentioned it, but Trick Shot really confuses me. Like this card. So I don't know. Were they just trying to push Shaper? Like, is that just it? But like, it is so much value packed into one card because it's two runs. It's got most of overclock on the first run and more than overclock on the second run. And it also adds multi-access and it's an event that costs one. Like what?
Yeah, it's a really good card. I don't think you can design your whole deck around it or anything, but I think Shapers are going to pack one or two of them.
I don't think you design your deck around it, but like there's no reason not to run it, right? Like, I feel like it's like a default card in a lot of ways because it just, it gives you so much value. Like, and you don't even have to be successful on the central run to get the second run. So you can just like run into something, bounce off a Tattoo Bola, and then go take your six money and trash some assets with it. Like, it's so weird.
It's definitely going to cause people to hopefully consider if, you know, playing against this card as a corp, you probably want to put something nasty on the outside of your R&D protection so that they can't just do that with the Trick Shot.
Right. But yeah, it's an interesting card. I just don't like most cards. I can look at it and say, okay, this is like X, but it has, you know, this difference to it. So, you know, like looking at like Carpe Diem is like Dirty Laundry, but you get the money first, but you can't choose the server, right? Like, you know, they're not exactly the same, obviously, but like, you know, that's kind of the way that I've assessed a lot of cards. And like, this is like somebody wrapped up, you know, run event with overclock with, you know, Maker's Eye kind of, and all these other things. Like, it's just so much stuff all kind of stacked into one card that it doesn't look exactly like any other card. And I don't understand, like, the equivalence of it. It just feels like it is out of step with a lot of other things. I'm not saying it's like bad for the game or anything. It's just like confusing from a design standpoint when in this game, it is generally so easy to see equivalences across the card pool where you're like, oh, well, this is like that, but for Shaper or, you know.
It's got hints-ish of things like Raindrops Cut Stone. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
You have to run. I'm not, maybe not too strong, just that you're running and have to run this other server thing. I don't know. But I'm happy that it exists. I think Shaper was the faction that was definitely needing the most help And it's, I haven't been in a Shaper meta, like when Shapers are kind of kick-ass. And they also got some really good breakers. They got Lobosomum. They got Catalogger, which is incredible.
Yes.
And then like Muse and Coalescence are two cards that I've been playing with a fair amount that are pretty neat. The amount of installing you can do with those and an environmental testing, it really feels like peak Shaper to me, where you're like installing six things on a turn and every one of them pushes you forward a little bit.
Burner. Burner is insane.
Burner. Burner is a card that I love playing with. I love that they gave us something that when you're like sitting across from the PD player who's just jamming that same seamless launch over and over again, you can be like, okay, well, let's put that in the bottom of your deck.
Right.
You can't have that anymore. Stop it. Bad. Bad PD.
Yeah.
And the kill decks that you're, you know, worried about dying and you can't protect yourself, you can, you know, last desperate click, run HQ with burner and go find the end of the line and put it on the bottom of the deck.
Right. Yeah. Even it, not even just putting stuff on the bottom of the deck, making them draw cards that they already drew. Like,
yeah, just
is
slowing
the
down.
Worst.
It's never really dead. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless HQ's like a brick wall or something, but
right.
Yeah, I'm mostly still excited about Runner. I have yet to have a ton of Corp aha moments. We've been playing a lot with Hollow Man in our local meta. I think that's a very easy card for people to throw in a deck and just make it better.
For sure, yeah.
I think that like Descent in Ob is pretty good.
Yep.
Just because it's a 2-cost ice and it lets you deal with Flood, which Ob tends to do. A local player from our group was playing a Nuvum deck that was kind of neat, and I didn't really see it coming. It was a punitive counter strike deck, but it also had clearinghouses in it, and it was like an Angeliques and stuff, and it was like killing me and surprised. I was surprised, and it worked pretty well. I was shocked.
Yeah, punitive.
I was pretty down on Nuvum.
Punitive out of that is interesting because you care less about the agendas getting dumped into archives from the ability, because if they go steal the agendas, so long as it's not enough for them to win the game, you can probably kill them on the next turn.
Right. The major complaint that I've seen, and Andre did a pretty extensive explanation of this on one of his streams on Stream Week when he was doing the Nuvum deck, is that punitive Counter-Strike is awkward in Nuvum because of the way the agenda suite gets distributed. You can't just do 3-costers. You have to put some 2-costers or 1-costers in your deck. And because of that, if you get unlucky, your punitive windows can close very quickly.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get a lot of money and you can trash stuff and be like, do you want to go check it? Go ahead, check it.
Yep.
Also, subliminal messaging in Nuvum is quite good.
Yes. Yeah. Just, I'm going to trash this off the top and then later I'll get it back. And it made me money both times.
Right. It seems good.
Yep.
You get it, you play it, you get a credit, and then you trash an operation and you get 2 more credits. And it's, yeah.
But yeah. Overall, it's a very interesting set just because I don't like... So much of the stuff that I looked at and I was like, oh, wow, this seems powerful. It doesn't fit exactly into an existing deck or into any existing game plan. It's just like this powerful tool that like I've kind of put in the back of my head, like the Helio Amphora and those kinds of cards just kind of like got slotted away where like this is going to be really strong at some point. I just don't know what that point is yet.
Right. There's a lot of powerful tech cards in here, I think.
Yes.
And then a lot of other cards that will probably just spawn off entire decks, like Amelia Earhart will probably spawn off some really crazy deck where the Corp just can't have any money.
Yeah, that's another one. Like the knife. I mean, if you're multi-accessing for 3 cards 3 times, you know, you have to be charging it in some other way. It's got to be like a Padma deck or something, right?
Yeah, I tried it on a Padma. I think it is a bit of a trap.
Yeah. But. No, I think that's like, but like, it has to be something like that where you are charging it in some other way. before it makes sense to me. But yeah. If you can figure out that charging thing, it seems like it, I mean, 10 money is a massive swing. So
one of the ideas I heard kicked around was you played it out of Ari and you get one down and you never run R&D. You never run it. You never run it. You're doing other stuff. You multi-access at HQ with like legworks. And then the turn that you get the power counters on it, you get the three and you let it sit there. And then when you're ready to go, you pop it. The corp has no money. You have a Peach of Shao and a conduit down, and they have no money to res ice on R&D, and you just run it forever. Making money off of coupons and stuff, but it just definitely seems kind of like hard to make that happen.
I was going to say, like, I mean, couldn't you also make the corp broke by forcing them to res the things on R&D? Like, yes, technically, you know, it's going to cost you money and everything, but like,
you just don't get the like unmitigated run a billion times with conduit runs and dig, 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 dig.
Yeah.
But you could just deep dive.
Exactly.
I don't know.
I don't know that you need it is what I'm saying. You know, it's a weird card. It's another one. So actually, I think Andre was talking about this on one of his streams where like, you know, is there any cost at which endurance would be balanced? And like it was like an 8 cost console, which was unheard of. And it was still like it just took over the meta, right?
Didn't matter.
And ended up getting banned. And I feel like Amelia Earhart is one of those cards where like, if you put it, you know, if you put a credit cost on it, it wouldn't matter because either people would find a way around it or the effect is so powerful they'd play it anyway. But like the multi-access requirement of it and the fact that you kind of have
to
let it cook for a while, like, those types of costs, I think, are the types of things where you can pile enough on that the card becomes like actually unplayable, even if the effect is really good. And again, I'm not trying to say that this card is unplayable. It seems very difficult to not win the game before you fire it, though. And that's kind of where I end up on it.
Yeah, that's why I get so mad when I'm trying to deep dive and I win on an access by accident. It's like, no.
Right.
Let me win with my cool trick.
Exactly.
And with that, you're like, oh, I was about to fire my Amelia when I multi-accessed a darn agenda and won the game.
Oh, man.
I know. I wanted to do my cool thing more than I wanted to win.
Yeah, I wanted to make the corp lose 10 money so that I could multi-access and win the
later
game.
Later and then win.
Yeah, but in like a different
bad
way.
Manners. Yeah, I need to do some BM first.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are the card things. Those are the Netrunner things. If you have thoughts on cards that are cool, let us know and we'll talk about it. Send us an email and all that stuff. We'll do that in a second. But before we get to the outro, we have some other stuff we want to talk about. Nick,
mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about Dune.
Yes. Not the
because,
movie.
Well, also kind of the movie and also the books and also all that stuff. So if you're not into Dune or don't care, you can tune out now, I guess. But stick with us for a second otherwise if you're interested. So I had never experienced anything with Dune. I guess I've known about it and I've seen as a like high schooler or middle schooler, I think I watched some of the made-for-TV movie, which I don't know anything about anymore.
Oh, the one that was on Sci-Fi?
Yeah.
Those were actually relatively faithful adaptations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which
I'd be
surprising.
Interested to go back and check it out now. But
I mean,
I never saw the Sting era movie that the one in the 80s,
which was not at all a faithful adaptation, but was kind of a cool movie.
Yeah. Nor did I read any of the books. And then I was actually walking out of Netrunner night the other night, this past Wednesday, and I saw Dune Imperium Uprising on the shelf. And I was like, I've heard about this, I hear it's really good. Also, hey, isn't the new Dune movie out? And it kind of like kicked me into thinking about Dune. And I found an audiobook reading George Goodall, I think, is doing the narrations. Very good. So I got that, started listening to that. And I was like, and I decided to go get that game. And then I saw part 2 the other night. And then we organized a meetup and played the game that I bought, Dune Imperium Uprising. We did that on
Saturday.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
That was yesterday.
Yep.
How'd it go? Tell us about it.
It's phenomenal. So it's a combination worker placement deck builder game where basically you are playing cards out to allow you to take different types of actions if they haven't been blocked by your opponents taking them before you. And then any cards that you don't play out, you turn into money for buying new cards with. So, you know, like every deck builder, there's kind of an engine. You end up, you know, based on the cards that you are seeing, you try to focus in on a particular thing. And it seems like there is a ton of variety in the deck. The cards that you could buy were insanely strong, especially relative to the base deck, which I feel like a lot of games don't get that right. And they're just kind of like littler upgrades than what these ended up being.
Yeah, the cards being powerful was very exciting. It was pretty cool. You know, we were all, the four of us playing, it was me, Nick, Johnny, and our buddy Adam. And every time a card would get replaced in the row, which happens like after you buy each card. So if you have like five persuasion, it's called, to spend on the cards, you spend two on one and you can't afford anything else. Or so, say you bought a three coster and you had two left over, but there was no twos. If it filled back in, you could get excited and there could be a two there. To buy, but we're all just like reacting to the cards that came on going, wait, does what? Like, that seems crazy.
Yeah.
Which is fun. It's a fun feeling.
Yeah. Anytime.
I also felt like the game did a fantastic job at mirroring what's going on in the universe and some of the story aspects. You know, I guess spoiler warnings. If you don't know what happened in that book that got published in the 60s, like me up until recently, but, like Lady Jessica's character that you can play as has a mechanic where you're going around and you collect memories and then you at some point can flip Lady Jessica and become, the Reverend Mother.
Yeah.
And for each memory that you have hosted, you get to draw a bunch of cards, which is like very on point with what happens mechanically, what's going on in the Bene Gesserit like rituals. That they describe in the book, which is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So like the flavor seems on point. The way everything worked seemed very like interestingly balanced. Like one of our players, Johnny, ended up going for like sandworms early. So he was able to get a bunch of sandworms and like really win the combat side of things, but like they weren't as durable. And I felt like we ended up ending the game a couple turns early, just due to time constraints. But if we had gotten to the final turns, I think the fact that a lot of us hadn't spent as many resources on those early battles would have ended up being big because we had all this stuff kind of stockpiled for the later ones.
Yeah, and that's specifically not including me in that conversation because I was so screwed.
Yeah. You were in a rough spot.
Yeah. But yeah, If this sounds interesting, you should go check the game out. I mean, honestly, if you haven't checked Dune out, I would. I'm 38 years old. I learned an hour or so ago, and it's really fun discovering something and getting to experience it. You know, it's like if you could go back and read your favorite book for the first time again,
right? Yeah.
I'm cognizant of the fact that I'm getting to do that. And maybe not my favorite book, but like one of those things, just this whole universe is like, oh man, this is really fucking cool. I love this.
Yes.
This is great. Sorry for the swearing, but yeah,
whatever. You're adults. Excited. But no, it's a great series. And
have you read all six books?
No. So I read the first two and I have read summations of the other ones. Children and God Emperor, and the series ends after God Emperor is my understanding, and all of the other stuff was like written decades later by Frank Herbert's son and is all like this background like information that you probably shouldn't get.
Yeah, I've heard that the stuff from his son is bad.
Not even just that it's tangential bad, but like it fills in gaps in the narrative that were not meant to be filled in, that were meant to be mysterious and poorly defined, but like, you know, it's like the Star Wars prequels, right? Like,
do fans like not consider it canon then?
I think it is contested because I believe they are based on like Frank Herbert's notes and stuff. But I don't know.
That's tricky.
Exactly.
I've heard that the first two books are like, you know, got to read it. It's Dune's history. The second two books are like Dune, like philosophy books.
Yes.
And then the fifth and sixth books are like horny, but weird.
Yeah. And I think those are the ones that his kid wrote.
Those were by him.
Oh, really?
And then after the six books, they were, yeah.
Gotcha.
They were the other ones.
Right. Cause it's
anyway.
I'm
just reading the first one right now. So
yeah. No, the second book is a really, really interesting change of pace. Like, it's just a completely different tone to everything. And in fact, it's weird. The other series that I would compare them to in terms of like the tonal shift between book one and book two is actually the Ender's Game series, where the first one is like all these cool fights and space battles and things. And then the second one is like, let's talk about the biology of this alien species for 400 pages. And also the concept of free will.
Yeah. Yes. Confirmed. The first six are by Frank Herbert. And then the seventh is Brian Herbert.
Well, there you go.
At least if you go on Goodreads and look at the series. Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, God Emperor of Dune, Heretics of Dune, Chapter House Dune, and then it goes off.
Yeah, God Emperor is where I have heard that, like, if you were digging it up to that point, that's probably the point to hop off.
Yeah, that's the impression I get. Like, okay, you're good here.
Yep, and even then, that might be too late for some people, because, there's a lot of weirdness in the later books.
If you are listening and you are a Dune fanatic, check in and talk to us about it. I'm curious. I want to know more stuff. I'm going to see about reading. I'll probably end up reading all six of these at least.
Yeah.
And by read, I mean, listen to someone nice read it to me, because I'm incapable of reading anymore. it's depressing, but I just, my attention span is challenged by Netrunner and making videos and podcasting and all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, I don't have a consistent time to read anymore.
Yeah. No, the thing that I found that got me reading again was I stopped bringing my cell phone to bed. It goes across the room, and then I just have books to fall asleep.
You're so smart. I say that too late, and then I go to bed without having an opportunity to do that.
Yeah. No. I mean, I say that. That's the trick that I found, but then I abandoned it because I like scrolling on my cell phone. So.
You like doom scrolling?
Yeah, exactly. It's not even doom scrolling anymore. I'm not on Twitter anymore.
Yeah. So, same.
Anyway.
All right. Well, that is a wrap for episode 15 of Neon Static. We've been your friends and hosts, Eric
and Nick.
If you want to get in touch with us about anything we've said during this podcast, we can be reached by email at neonstaticpod@gmail.com. We're also neonstaticpod on Instagram and Mastodon. Our handles on Discord are Canister and Goldbrander. A link to the New Hampshire Netrunners Discord will be in the show notes, where you can always find us. And please subscribe to our YouTube channel to catch videos where we live stream and create videos. We've got some cool projects in the works there, so keep an eye on that. Subscribe, bell, etc. Engage, comment, engagement. And then consider supporting us on Patreon if you'd like what we do. That's patreon.com/neonstatic. Anyway.
Thanks for listening.
And remember to run with your eyes closed.